An 8-page handout here, which is based on the 18th Psalm. And each morning we'll be taking a section of that Psalm. And when you're all through, if you want a project, take a pair of scissors and put the Psalm back together in the order it's supposed to be, because it's all mixed up. And we'll be studying it under 5 headings. The first heading is heart preparation for the battle. The second is mental and psychological preparation for battle. The third is page 4, skill preparation for the battle. And then God's involvement in the battle. And then David and his warriors part in the battle. So that'll be the 5 things we'll consider. Now, you notice in the introduction to this psalm, about the middle of that paragraph, he sang to the Lord the words of this song when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. So after the victory had been won, about 7 years or so fighting, it's all over. And he sat down and wrote this marvelous song. I think it's a kind of a microcosm of his life. And in it, we find a way to prepare for our total life's involvement. We find a way of a pattern for daily battles and then for periodic battles. So I'm going to read, and you follow the part that's printed here under heart preparation for the battle. I call to the Lord, who is worthy of praise, and I am saved from my enemies. My cry came before him into his ears. The Lord has dealt with me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has rewarded me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord. I have not done evil by turning from my God. All his laws are before me. I have not turned away from his decrees. I have been blameless before him, and have kept myself from sin. The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. Throughout the psalm, he includes a number of doxologies, and we'll also take one of those each day as we end. David, at the beginning of the 7 years, at the beginning of his life, and at the beginning of every day, had to get ready for that which faced him. He had to prepare his heart. So we notice in this part that we read that he started out by calling on the Lord. And then in verse 22, he said, all his laws are before him, for me. He exposed himself to the Word of God. I think it was Dawson Trotman I first heard say this. I guess it was written in his Bible, on his Bible, that sin will keep you from the Word, or the Word will keep you from sin. So in the preparation of his heart, he prayed, he exposed himself to the Word. Now several things happened, and the first one that we want to note is in verse 23. He said, I have been blameless before him and have kept myself from my sin. Hebrews chapter 12 indicates that I guess all of us have a besetting sin. And it can hinder victory in the day, victory in the battle, victory in the big battle. So the first thing David wanted to do is get this straight. And he said, as a result of prayer and the exposure to the Word, I've decided to turn away from my sin. I think from that he had a particular besetting sin. I remember a conference we had out here several years ago. One of the people in my discussion group was an Air Force general, and he was just being reassigned as the deputy commander of the Air Force in Europe. And in our discussion group, we asked what the expectations of each person was. And he said, well, I'm taking on a big job. And I just want to be sure that everything's right between me and the man upstairs. So he recognized to be successful in that great responsibility that he had to make sure things were right. So this was paramount in David's thoughts. In verse 23 in your printed page there, you see I'm not a very good proofreader. And that word for should be changed to from. So please change that because it means just the opposite the way it's written. Now he said in verse 21, I have steadfastly kept the ways of the Lord. He made a resolve not only to turn from sin, but to do something very positively. We'll be talking about as we go ahead in the future. I met for 3 hours yesterday afternoon with a couple. The lady recently came to Christ. The man has been a Christian for some time, but has been struggling. And he said, now, as I understand the Bible, now that I've come to Christ, I'm saved forever. So I don't have to be too particular about what I do. So we turn to 2 Corinthians 1:10, and I showed him that salvation is threefold. Who delivered us from so great a death, deliverance from the penalty of sin, and doth deliver. We're delivered from the power of sin, in whom we trust that he will yet deliver us. We're going to be delivered from the very presence of sin in the future. So David said, I turned from my sin, and he entered into the power of salvation, to be kept from the power of sin. And then in verses 20 and 24, he talks about the cleanness that he experienced. He said, according to the cleanness of my hands, he rewarded me. In verse 24 again, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. I heard a testimony of a man recently, and he said, when I came to Christ, he said, the greatest feeling I had was that I was clean in my mind, in my heart, all over. Well, Isaiah 1:18 says that we'll be made as white as snow. So, having turned from his sin and resolved to go on, he said he felt this cleanness. And then in verse 23, he also said that he experienced being blameless. And that sounds like the New Testament justification of a doctrine of justification, where that God is not only forgiven, he's not only forgotten, but through justification, he is by decree and declared that our sin never happened in the first place. So he said, I'm blameless. Now, can't you see how he's really getting psyched up for the day and for the battle here? And then he said in verse 24 that he experienced righteousness. I take that to mean Christ's imparted righteousness. I think about sometime as I'm touring around heaven, I think maybe the tour guide is going to say, is there anything we may have missed that you want to see? And I'm going to say, in fact, there is. I want to see the personnel office. And so it's not out of bounds, so we go to the personnel office. What do you want? I want to see my record. So as I look in the files there and see the attendant looking for my record, I notice that on one side of the drawer, there's some real thin folders, just like this. And on the other side, they're so thick, it'll hardly hold. So I notice that the attendant takes this empty file with my name on it, takes one of these big fat ones, puts all the contents in mine, hands it to me and says, this is yours. Well, I'm curious about where the contents came from. And I look over and I see that this file is labeled Jesus Christ. I say there must be some mistake. No. The scripture says that God has imputed to us the righteousness of Jesus Christ. And then finally in verse 20 here, David said that according to the cleanness of my hands, he has rewarded me. I suppose all of us have occasionally watched a TV program where that somebody won a big prize or a lottery ticket or something. You ever notice how they respond to the reward? It's emotionally, isn't it? They haven't bought anything at the price. They haven't taken it home, but emotionally. So I think the great reward David was experiencing and that we experience is emotional ecstasy and fulfillment. So I can see David getting all ready for the battle, can't you? In his heart preparation. Now the doxology to end this session with is on the next page. As for God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is flawless. He is a shield for all who take refuge in him. For who is God besides the Lord? And who is the rock except our God? 20 times in the Psalms, David referred to God as the rock. And I still don't know what that means. I'm trying to find out why he used that expression. You know, I have some ideas, but none of them satisfy me. But I printed another verse here from Deuteronomy 32. How could one man chase 1,000 or two put 10,000 to flight? For their rock is not like our rock, as even our enemies concede. We moved here a few months ago from Arlington, Virginia, and the place in where we lived had been landscaped with huge boulders. Well, they weren't all the same size. So one day my neighbor told me, he said, I've found a verse that describes our front yard. And so I was anxious to hear about it. And so he read this verse in another translation, which says, for our rock is greater than their rock. And to this, even our enemies agree. Well, he did it in fun. But for days and days after that, as I compared my situation with that of those who are not Christians, I said, well, all I've got to do is take one look and see that my rock is greater than their rock. Well, I don't know what he meant by rock these 20 times, but maybe you can figure that out. But the application we made here in this first lesson, the middle of page 2, there's no greater way to begin this day and this week of life's battle than to prepare our hearts as David did, by confessing and resolutely forsaking the intent to repeat sin and thereby experience all that David enjoyed in his relationship with God as he prepared to do battle. I'm trusting the Lord to give you a great day and a great week. After Psalm 18 that we're studying, remember again the introduction. At Psalm 18, he sang to the Lord the words of this psalm when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. So as Paul looked back on this long struggle, these are the words that he wrote. And it's not possible, I think, to separate them exactly into what he thought before he went in the battle, what he thought during the battle, and what he thought after the battle. But we've tried to sort them out the best we could on these several headings. And today we're talking about his mental and psychological preparation for the battle. Let's read. I'll read and you follow this portion of Psalm 18 we have. To the faithful, this is on page 2, the bottom. You will show yourself faithful. To the blameless, you will show yourself blameless. To the pure, you will show yourself pure. But to the crooked, you show yourself shrewd. You save the humble, but bring low those whose eyes are haughty. You, O Lord, keep my lamp burning. My God turns my darkness into light. With your help, I can advance against a troop.
With my God, I can scale a wall. Then let's look at the doxology number 2 on page 4. Definitely he's looking back now at this time. You have delivered me from the attacks of the people. You have made me the head of nations. People I did not know are subject to me. As soon as they hear me, they obey me. Foreigners cringe before me. They all lose heart. They come trembling from their strongholds. Of the first part that we read, there are three words we want to highlight, and they are humble, haughty, and advance. We don't neglect the importance of these items in the middle of page 3, verse 25. He talked about faithfulness. And later his son wrote, like a bad tooth or a lame foot is reliance on the unfaithful. And he also repeated the idea in verse 25 of being blameless, 26 of being pure, 28 of being enlightened. But the three words we want to particularly emphasize this morning, as I said, are these words, humble, haughty, and advance. In verse 27, you save the humble, but bring low those whose eyes are haughty. Yesterday we saw how that David dealt with his besetting sins. Today, he first of all had to deal with the matter of pride. Somebody said that pride is the only disease of the human race that makes everybody sick except the person who has it. David had some weaknesses, but pride was not one of them. I think about this touching incident over in 2 Samuel 3:38, after Abner had been murdered by Joab. The king said to his men, "Do you not realize that a prince and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? And today, though I am anointed king, I am weak. And these sons of Zeruiah are too strong for me." Pride wasn't one of his weaknesses. I heard about a conversation where that one person who seemed to be in touch with God was being talked to by a person that really didn't believe that. And he said, okay, you claim you're in touch with God. Tell me, what's he doing right now? At this very instant, what's God doing? So he quoted to him 1 Peter 5:5, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And he said, God's doing right now what he's been doing through all out of eternity, and that is opposing the proud. Well, I thought that was a pretty good answer. Now, one other thought on that. I heard about the newly ordained Church of England priest. And in his first sermon, he wanted to make a good impression on the people. So he practiced, memorized his sermon. He stood in front of the mirror and practiced his gestures. And when he walked up that morning, he was very sure that he was really going to be a knockout. So he delivered his message, and the more he went through it, the flatter it seemed to fall. So he was a little bit downcast at the end of it. Nobody stayed behind to shake his hand. As he walked out, the only person there was the janitor, the only person left to close the door. And he looked and saw his situation, and he said to him, "If you had come down, no, excuse me, if you had gone up as you came down, you would have come down as you went up." Well, David dealt with this. Now, the other word of importance in this is the word advance in verse 29. David was psychologically and mentally prepared for the offense to move. During World War I, the French army was fighting a battle with the German army. They were falling back. The Germans penetrated the center of the line. One flank collapsed. The other was falling back. This report was given to Marshal Foch, who was the commander. And when he got the report, he said, "The situation is excellent. I shall attack." And he did, and won the battle. If you travel in France today, you'll see a statue of Marshal Ferdinand Foch. And underneath the statue, there are only four words in French, and they are, "Attack, attack, always attack." Actually, only two words repeated. After World War I, the Secretary of Defense for France was a man named André Maginot. And so he built the Maginot Line between France and Germany. And they went on the defense. And you remember when World War II broke out, the Germans went right around behind the Maginot Line. The guns were pointing where they weren't any enemy. And France was defeated in 50 days in World War II. Marshal Foch's motto was attack, attack, always attack, not the defensive. You've probably heard about the time that a newspaper reporter asked General Eisenhower, "Why don't you get rid of General Patton? He embarrasses you again and again." And General Eisenhower said, "Because he is the best general that I've got." And the reporter said, "What do you mean?" He said, "He's the only general I've got that when I say move, I know that he'll move." Because that was very important to General Eisenhower. David said, "With your help, I can advance. Not only that, but I can scale the wall." I've got a quotation here on page 3 from Sam Shoemaker. He says, "We need to look often into one another's eyes with love, with truth, and with trust. But then we need to look away from ourselves to the huge task that confronts all followers of Christ today and vow to one another that loyalty that it will take to storm and conquer and hold one outpost in the front line of the kingdom." Now, I said here toward the bottom of the page, Christians should not always be on the defensive. I get embarrassed often because we're beat around by the press. We're beat around by the government. And it seems like our posture is really more being on the defensive than it is the offensive. With God's help, we can scale the walls and infiltrate the chief strongholds of the enemy and possess them for God. As I've tried to analyze what the main strongholds of the enemy are, I believe that they are a godless education system, a news and information media, a godless government, godless entertainment industry, and all of them have us on the defensive, school, government, court, everybody. But the attitude of David was, with God's help, I can advance. And as far as I know, David never thought about a defensive posture. Like Marshal Foch, attack, attack, on the offensive. So my conclusion of this particular portion is that David had the great balance. And he was like Paul, who said, "I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me." But as David undertook this campaign, he undertook it with a very positive attitude that with God's help, we're going to advance. And no wall is too great a barrier. We'll go right over it. The enemy is using this wall for defense. We'll go right over it and take over. Well, let's particularly take Sam Shoemaker's words to heart. Vow to one another that loyalty that it will take to storm and conquer and hold one outpost in the front line of the kingdom. Okay, we're in another section of the 18th Psalm this morning. And we'll read both the portion and the doxology.
Now let's read it all together. It is God who arms me with strength. Now I'll start over again. Everybody got the place here? It's the middle of page 4. Ready? It. Say it. Okay, now we go. It is God who arms me with strength and makes my way perfect. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to stand on the heights. He trains my hands for battle. My arms can bend a bow of bronze. You give me the shield of victory, and your right hand sustains me. You stoop down to make me great. You broaden the path beneath me so that my ankles do not turn. And then over in the middle of page 5, doxology number 3. Together. They confronted me in the day of my disaster, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. Well, we're spending a lot of time in preparation for the battle, aren't we? We've got one more day of preparation. Tomorrow, we get into the height of the battle. And then also Friday, we'll finish it up. We notice in verse 32 that we read, it is God who arms me with strength. And verse 34, he trains my hands for battle, my arms can bend a bow of bronze. The Living Letters translates this, a bow of iron or a bow of steel. I would suppose that an ordinary wood bow is maybe kind of weak and vulnerable. So who would think of making one out of iron or steel? It would be useless in the hands of somebody that didn't have a great deal of strength. So in his skill preparation for the battle, he has toned up his muscles. He and all the men, so they have this extraordinary strength. In verse 33, I think probably the outstanding verse in this entire passage, he makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to stand on the heights. I was with Dan Pyatt over in Europe one summer, and he had been talking to a British Bible scholar that explained to him what this verse 33 meant. He said he's talking about a mountain deer, and the Living Letters, by the way, translates this, the feet of a mountain goat. But what some researcher wondered, now, just what is special about this deer? So he investigated and found out that it has such a fine sense of balance that you can go up in the mountain where this deer has been climbing, take a magnifying glass with you, and you find that when the deer moves his front foot, he puts the hind foot down in the exact same spot with such precision that with a magnifying glass you can only find one hoof print. That sounds like it's stretching a little bit, but that's at least what he reported. But that is a very fine sense of balance, isn't it? Where he can move. So the deer up in the mountain, with that fine sense of balance, doesn't have to worry about the heights. This has been a favorite verse of people down through the ages. I remember back in 1978 when the Navigators asked me at age 65 to leave the security of my nest here in Colorado Springs and on the grounds and move over to London and be responsible for the Navigator ministry in Europe, Middle East, and Africa. That I thought, well, I know less about that part of the ministry than any other. I'd spent a lot of time in the Pacific and a lot in Latin America, but practically none over there. So I asked the Lord for a promise, and this is the one that he gave me, that he doesn't set us on high places without first giving us the sense of balance that we need. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer And then he enables me to stand on the heights. So I felt like, yes, there's a lot I don't know. But God wouldn't send me over there unless I was prepared to handle everything that needed to be handled. And as some of you folks go overseas and are looking ahead at other assignments, you know that's true, that he doesn't send you until he equips you. So David, I'm sure, and his men felt a great deal of comfort in this. Now toward the bottom, I've got that down in the first paragraph on the top, page 5, as it's describing his men. And he says, in the last, they were as swift as the roes upon the mountain. Not only were their muscles tuned up, but they could run. And they weren't joggers. It doesn't look like. I tell you, anybody that can run as fast as a deer is in good shape. So this was a part of their skill preparation. Now you notice down to the bottom, verse 36, you broaden the path beneath me so that my ankles do not turn. A few weeks ago, I spent a weekend at a conference ground in southern Colorado called Horn Creek Ranch. And it's, there's a reason that the Rocky Mountains are called the Rocky Mountains. What do you suppose that is, why they call the Rocky Mountains? Well, our cabins were located so that you could either follow this wide path or you could take a shortcut. So I tried to take a shortcut. And the rocks, no two of them were alike, spaced alike. And I found out that I had to just set 1 foot at a time and then be very careful to move ahead. I lost time by the shortcut because of the rocks. Now, I couldn't even walk over the unevenness of those rocks, much less run. So I can see what a great hazard that would be to these warriors in rocky terrain. And I often wondered if we could see that battle, if we wouldn't see more of the enemy lying out on the ground with turned ankles than we would that had been injured in the battle. But he said in verse 34, you broaden the path beneath me so that my ankles do not turn. So what a tribute to the detail with which he was expecting God to look after him, not turn an ankle in that awful terrain. Well, this is kind of the final stage of preparation for the battle. First of all, we saw how that David dealt with his sins and his besetting sins. Then yesterday, how that he dealt with pride. And then how he got the mental and psychological preparation, not a defensive mentality, but an offensive mentality. I mentioned that we need to infiltrate. And when I got home yesterday, I read Joseph Sobrand's column where he was mentioning the new Supreme Court Justice, Judge Scalia, who took the minority opinion in the case down in Louisiana of where the Supreme Court says, no, you can teach evolution without teaching creation science. And he said that Scalia's minority opinion is one that will go down in history as one of the greatest, because he showed how that Judge Brennan, who wrote the majority position, his reasoning was faulty all the way along. And I think you want to read that to see what this man had to say. Well, when we get the Supreme Court, school board, and the media infiltrated with people on our side, it's going to make a difference. We need to be on the offensive, not on the defensive. In connection with this skill preparation, while I was in the Navy, I served with an admiral who was one of the most decorated officers in the Navy. During World War II, every mission that he went on, he not only was successful, but he got decorated for being extraordinary. So I was visiting with him one day. He was my commanding officer. And I said, now you must have some secret. And now, how is it that you were always successful, accomplished every mission, and then got decorated for it? He said, well, there were three things. He said, the first was that my men knew that we had the best equipment in the world. Our enemies didn't have any equipment like ours. The second, he said that every one of them had their personal affairs in order. He said they made out a will, they had life insurance, they had detailed directions, so they knew if they didn't come back, there was nothing that they could have done to have prepared for not returning. And then he said the third thing was they knew their equipment perfectly. They knew how to operate it. There wasn't nothing they could do. And that reminded me of Marine officers training at Quantico when I was back in that area. I knew a young officer candidate there. And he said one of the things that everybody in the school had to do before they could become a Marine officer. Those days, the 50 caliber machine gun was big piece of equipment. But they had to, they give them all the parts of a 50 caliber machine gun in a bucket. And they had to put it together. But he said, the officer had to do it blindfolded. So the Marines knew that their leaders knew how to use the weapons. And they could pick one out of the dark and put it together. So David and his men, their skill training was perfect. Nothing more that could be done that to make them ready for the battle. And yet, they didn't trust in their skill. Verse 35 says, you give me your shield of victory, and your right hand sustains me. You stoop down and make me great. All the skill possible to get, and yet still depended on God for the victory. Well, as I've thought about this, what are the spiritual skills which parallel these human skills that we're talking about? Seems to be that the bottom line, we'll talk more about this toward the end of the week, in the Christian life is heart and skill. That's what we're after, the heart and the skill. That's what we want everybody else to have, the heart and the skill. And I believe that God has raised up the navigators to help the body of Christ with the skills that are necessary for a victorious personal life and victory in the battle. So as to what parallels the physical skills are most of the things the navigators emphasize. These are the skills. Now, just one further word that seems contradictory and a kind of a paradox. Seems to me that the greater skills that we have, the less we get to use them. And I'd like to illustrate that just in personal evangelism. Now, when you're talking with somebody about Christ, there's a couple of observers that are looking the situation over. One is God, and one is the devil. And the devil is trying to embarrass you and make you lose. So he'll have his man ask, where did Cain get his wife? And if you don't know the answer, why, you're a little embarrassed and have to retreat. But if you have a good answer to that, will the devil ever bring it up? Because he doesn't want his man embarrassed, so he won't bring it up. So here David and his men had all these skills. But somehow, we'll see as we go on, they really didn't get to use them because God did all the battle. But that's no excuse for not having the skills just because we won't get a chance to use them. And that's the way that we make sure that we won't have to use them, is to be ready. So ends the third study in the 18th Psalm on David with his heart preparation, his mental and psychological preparation, his skill preparation, and tomorrow, the climax of it. I think Friday being at a climax, because tomorrow is the big battle. As I've been reflecting on the life of David, I've been trying to find out if he ever lost a battle. And as far as I can find out, he never did. He did have a little lapse in his time with his son Absalom, but he ended up by winning. But tell me if I'm wrong, but I think he never lost a battle. Now, we're going to have kind of a double header here this morning. I'm going to read the first part of the scripture that's on page 5 on the handout, and then Kirk Humphreys is going to help me on the second, because that second part deserves treatment that my voice can't give it, but I think that his can. So, looking at the scripture at the bottom of page 5, under the heading of God's involvement in the battle, the cords of death entangle me, the torrents of destruction overwhelm me, the cords of the grave coiled around me, the snares of death confronted me, in my distress. Things don't look too bright, do they, at this point? In my distress, I called to the Lord. I cried to my God for help. From his temple, he heard my voice. My cry came before him into his ears. And then this is what happened.
The earth trembled and quaked, and the foundations of the mountain shook. They trembled because he was angry. Smoke rose from his nostrils. Consuming fire came from his mouth. Burning coals blazed out of it. He parted the heavens and came down. Dark clouds were under his feet. He mounted the cherubim and flew. He soared on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him, the dark rain clouds of the sky. Out of the brightness of his presence, clouds advanced with hailstones and bolts of lightning. The Lord thundered from heaven. The voice of the Most High resounded. He shot his arrows and scattered his enemies, great bolts of lightning, and routed them. The valleys of the sea were exposed, and the foundations of the earth laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of breath from your nostrils.
Now I have a question for you. Did that really happen, or was David just imagining that it happened? Pretty strong statements in here. He parted the heavens and came down. Dark clouds were under his feet. He soared on the wings of the wind. The Lord thundered from heaven. The valleys of the sea were exposed. Well, I think it must have happened. But I think that David was the only one who saw how that God was coming to his rescue. Now, just in reviewing here on page 6, in spite of his own skills and his army's skills, he faced destruction, he faced death, he was in distress. When he cried for help, God shook the earth, he blazed fire and smoke, he parted the heavens and came to the battle in person, he soared on the wind, his brilliance shone against a backdrop of blackness. Out of his presence came hailstones and bolts of lightning. The Most High's thundering voice vibrated heaven and earth. At God's rebuke and with his weapons, the enemy was routed as the earth rocked with a giant earthquake. David had considerable resources on his side in the battle as God got involved. This morning I'm going to quote a couple of incidents from Billy Graham's book, called Angels, God's Secret Agents. He tells about a story of a doctor in Philadelphia had gone to bed after an exceptionally tiring day. Suddenly he was awakened by someone knocking at his door. Opening it, he found a little girl, poorly dressed and deeply upset. She told him her mother was very sick and asked him if he would please come with her. It was a bitterly cold, snowy night, and though he was bone-tired, Dr. Mitchell dressed and followed the girl. He found the mother desperately ill with pneumonia. After arranging for medical care, he complimented the sick woman on the intelligence and persistence of her little daughter. The woman looked at him strangely and said, "My daughter died a month ago." She added, "Her shoes and coat are in the clothes closet." Dr. Mitchell, amazed and perplexed, went to the closet. There hung the very coat worn by the little girl who had brought him to tend to her mother. It was warm and dry and could not possibly have been out in the wintry night. And Billy Graham asked the question, could the doctor have been called in the hour of desperate need by an angel who appeared at this woman's, as this woman's young daughter? Was this the work of God's angels on behalf of the sick woman? And he doesn't answer. Then he tells about a missionary in the New Hebrides, tells a thrilling story involving the protective care of angels. Hostile natives surrounded his mission headquarters one night, intent on burning the Pattons out and killing them. John Patton and his wife prayed all during the terror-filled night that God would deliver them. When daylight came, they were amazed to see the attackers unaccountably leave. They thanked God for delivering them. A year later, the chief of the tribe was converted to Christ, and Mr. Patton, remembering what had happened, asked the chief what had kept him and his men from burning down the house and killing them. The chief replied in surprise, "Who were all those men you had with you there?" The missionary answered, "There were no men, just my wife and I." The chief argued that they had seen many men standing guard, hundreds of big men in shining garments with drawn swords in their hands. They seemed to circle the mission station so that the natives were afraid to attack. Well, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And as David is in the midst of battle in distress, God gave him a glimpse onto how God was undertaking behind the scenes. Another account in the Bible which closely parallels this is found in 2 Kings 6:17. It sounds like today's headlines, Israel and Syria were fighting. And every time that the Syrian general sent out a party to ambush the Israelites, the Israelites went right around it. So the king was really upset, and he said the only way that the Israelites could know where we're setting up the ambush is because somebody in this room is telling them. We're the only ones that know. So the purpose of this meeting is to find out who the spy is and deal with him. Well, one of the men spoke up and said, "It's none of us. It's a man named Elijah. And he tells his troops the words that you say in your bedroom." So the king said, "We've got to get him." And so they sent a big army to surround Elijah and his companion. So when they woke up in the morning, they looked around, and here was this Syrian army totally surrounding them. The young man who was Elijah's servant panicked. And he said, "What do we do?" And Elijah said, "They that be with us are more than they that be with them." Now, I think Elijah's servant had great respect for his spirituality, but not too much for his mathematical ability. And then the prayer that is written here at the bottom of page 6. And Elijah prayed, "O Lord, open his eyes that he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. The enemy couldn't touch him because of this unseen army. Well, in spiritual warfare, God is the principal person operating, isn't he? And David, even though they were trained, they were psychologically and mentally ready, they were spiritually ready, and yet it was God who came to the rescue. But the greatest spiritual battle that's going on today is in a different realm, and I want to talk about just one incident of that. I knew a Chinese Christian man. I visited him in the peninsula of Macau, about 40 miles from Hong Kong. It was formerly a Portuguese colony where he was a refugee. He had no home country or passport, fine Christian man, and had a good ministry going in Macau. Later he did get out, came to visit us here in the States, and I asked Frank, I said, what happened to your ministry? You know, you had a good ministry going there. He said, well, you remember the other day I was telling you about Timothy. I turned my ministry over to Timothy. And then I remembered what he told me about Timothy. As the more wealthy Chinese families saw communism moving in, they did what they've done other times in history. They sent out the oldest member of their family with a part of their money to establish a business in some other country so that they could eventually bring the rest of the families out. So Frank, Jean, and Timothy had been two of these wealthy first sons. As Timothy was growing up, the family being wealthy, he had an ama to take care of him. After he left home, she was so fond of him, she wanted to know every year how he was doing. So she would go visit the spirit medium, pay her some money, and she would bring a report back. And this went on for several years. One year, when the ama went to the spirit medium and paid her money, she went into a seance or whatever they do, came back and said, I'm sorry, I have no information. And she said, now you've been doing very well all these years. You must be able to do better. Now you go back and try again. So she did, came back, said, no contact. I'm sorry, I have no information. I cannot make contact. Then Frank said, we projected back. And that was the year that Timothy became a Christian. And so that gave new meaning to the commission that Paul gave to Christ in Acts 26. He said, I am sending you to open their eyes and turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God. As long as we're not Christians, we're in another kingdom. But once we've been delivered out of the kingdom of Satan into the kingdom of Christ, there's no further contact. At least that was the experience of Timothy. So we've talked about earlier in the Christian warfare, we need to infiltrate, and I think we do. But the greatest spiritual warfare that's going on today and the greatest victories are when God delivers us, not in battle, but when he delivers an individual out of the power of Satan into the kingdom of God and under his power. So I believe this account in the 18th Psalm is a true account of God coming to David's rescue, but it's a picture of a much greater battle. And there's more to the gospel than the bridge illustration and the four spiritual laws. When we present the gospel and a person responds, as God told Paul, their eyes are opened, they're turned from darkness to light and delivered from the power of Satan to God. So as we reflect on God's involvement in David's material battle, we also have a picture of his involvement in a much more important battle. We'll finish up the 18th Psalm tomorrow. Well, let's read the scripture. You've been singing the doxology, so we won't cover that. In the middle of page 7, I pursued my enemies and overtook them. I did not turn back till they were destroyed. I crushed them so that they might not rise. They fell beneath my feet. You armed me with strength for battle. You made my adversaries bow at my feet. You made my enemies turn their backs in flight and destroyed my foes. They cried for help, but there was no one to save them. To the Lord, but he did not answer. I beat them as fine as dust borne on the wind. I poured them out like mud in the streets. Several years ago, a family was visiting the Grand Canyon for the first time, and the family was interested to know what one of their small sons wrote in his diary after seeing that great sight the Grand Canyon is. So he wrote in his diary, "Today, I spit a mile." Well, he didn't carve out the Grand Canyon, and he didn't invent the law of gravity, but he took a lot of credit for what happened. In David's summation here, verse 37, he said, "I pursued, I overtook, I destroyed, I crushed them, I beat them." And then also in here he said, however, it really wasn't me. Verse 39, "You armed me with strength for the battle. You made my adversaries bow at my feet. You made my enemies turn their backs in fight. And I destroyed my foes after that." Well, I'm trying to find out a way to wind up this 18th Psalm. I want to read a part of a paragraph from an editorial that appeared in the French communist newspaper, Peace and Liberty. He says, "The gospel of Jesus Christ is a much more powerful society, a weapon for the renewal of society than is our Marxist doctrine." So we'd certainly agree with that part of the editorial, wouldn't we? And he goes on to say, "All the same, it is we who will beat you. We are only a handful, and you Christians are numbered by the millions. But if you remember the story of Gideon and his 300 companions, you will understand why I am right." So I think what he was saying was that we've read the Bible. We learned a lesson from Gideon, his 300. We're going to apply it and win. You don't apply it, and so you're going to lose. Well, there's a lesson to be learned from Gideon and his 300. Just to review briefly what happened, you remember that God had Gideon mobilize an army, and they were to deliver his people from the Midianites. They, after the army was mobilized, they numbered 32,000. But Gideon followed the instructions given in Deuteronomy and said, "Now, if there are any cowards, anybody that's afraid, go home." So 22,000 went home. They had no heart for the battle. Then the remaining 10,000 were given a little test. And when they were hot and thirsty, they got down to a stream of water. 9,700 of them dropped on their hands and knees, it seems, and began to drink the water like a horse, and then take their hands and wash it off, forgetting there were enemies behind the rocks and the trees. So God said, "Send the 9,700 home. They have the heart, but not the skill for battle." Then God told Gideon, "With the 300, I'm going to save you." So he put them in a line, and apparently they were spread out just far enough that you could make voice contact with the next. And they had a torch. Each leader had a torch and a pitcher and bugle and a good strong voice. So they were not on the defensive. They attacked the Midianite camp that had 135 enemy soldiers in it. And as they went in, you remember, they broke the pitchers to expose their torches. They shouted. They played the bugle. And the Midianites, as they took a look out there, they assumed that each of these torches and bugles represented a company commander. So between him and the next were 100 people. So they saw this line. And so the Midianites were really defeated by the people that didn't exist. They felt people moving in the camp, assumed that it was some of these 99 in between the company commanders that had penetrated, and they began to fight each other. Not a one out of the 300 was touched. I think the key verse in this passage, Judges 7:21, says they stood, every man in his place. Well, what that says to me is that God's looking for front men. And the kind he's looking for have both the heart and the skill for the battle. We've talked about David and his soldiers' skill, not much about their heart. But in page 7, no, it's the last page here, as one of David's advisors was describing him, he said, "You know your father and his men. They are fighters, and as fierce as a wild bear robbed of her cubs. Then even the bravest soldier, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a fighter, and that those with him are brave." Now, I think somebody that has a heart of a lion is to be admired. That's quite a person. But what do you call a person that melts the heart of the lion-hearted? Well, that was David. That's what this man says now. Even though they're lion-hearted, once they find out your father's on the rampage, they'll melt with fear. Well, that's kind of a heart that David and his men had to go with their skill. You've been singing a doxology, and so we won't read the last part, but it comes out of that part. Actually, there's at least four songs that have been written out of the 18th Psalm, and I hope you'll think of the one you've just been singing every time you turn to it. But to conclude with the application in the middle of page 8, Christ is recruiting valiant followers with heart and skill. In the final analysis, they are but front men whose willingness to engage in spiritual warfare provide the stage for the manifestation of his intervention and glorious victory. Now, it seems to me like that God get a great deal of glory and get a lot done if he took just some ordinary people. But the scriptural pattern seems to be that in order to manifest his power and his glory and his victory, he uses men like Gideon's 300, and he uses men like David and his army. And the bottom line of describing them, in my estimation, is it's those who have the heart and the skill for the battle. Well, it's been a lot of fun being with you this week, and I've gotten a lot out of the 18th Psalm as we've studied together, and I expect to continue reading it and get a lot more out of it, and I trust you will too.